This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Dr. Mark Courtney of the University of Chicago, and we will talk about foster care in Louisiana and across the country and some of the challenges that are evident in this capacity. Also on the show, we will talk with Hunter Torito, Baton Rouge Advertising Representative. He met with members of the Jindal administration yesterday, the Department of Revenue, regarding a potential advertising tax that could be in the offing if Governor Jindal's tax swap program is embraced by lawmakers. And Deacon Dan Bornay on the new Pope, and we'll talk with Dan Bornay also about what happened 25 years ago today when Buddy Romer became governor of Louisiana. All this, now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Your numbers are 877-217-5757 or 297-5633. You may reach us via email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We lead off with Dr. Mark Courtney, professor in the School of Social Service Administration at the University of Chicago. He is an expert on foster care and the foster care system in the United States, and he is in Louisiana for a major event tomorrow at Louisiana Resource Center at 5550 Florida Boulevard. There will be the 6th Annual Family Impact Seminar regarding foster care, and it is from 8 to 11:45 in the morning. And good morning to you, Dr. Courtney.
Good morning.
Well, tell us about foster care and the problems, challenges, if you will, that we're having not only in Louisiana, but across the country.
Well, my focus, the focus of the seminar tomorrow, is on older youth in foster care. Foster care is obviously a big system. We end up serving as parents. The way I look at foster care really is it's society's commitment to protecting children, and in some cases we go as far as to need to step in as a parent. And I think a real challenge for the child welfare system for a number of years has been the fact that typically the systems kick kids out at the age of 18. And that's just really not normative behavior anymore. Parents typically provide support to their young adult children well into adulthood. And so that's really the focus of the seminar, and it's been something I've focused on for the last 25 years since I worked with these kids.
Well, statistics reveal that a large percentage do not complete high school. So what happens to these kids when they're kicked out at 18?
Well, not surprisingly, if you don't finish high school these days, you have a real hard time functioning in the labor market. And one of the things we find is that the young people who, I use the term age out of foster care, are much more likely than their peers to be homeless, to not go to college, to not be employed, to have children who they're having a hard time parenting. They also have, not surprisingly, a lot of them have, mental and behavioral health problems. I mean, they were in abusive homes for many years before they entered care.
Well, a recent study revealed that 27% of males, 10% of females are incarcerated within 18 months. Those numbers are not good.
No, they're not. And again, probably not surprising if you're sort of thrown out the door at the age of 18, and on average, these young people are reading at less than an eighth grade level. Only about half of them have any work experience before the age of 18. Really shouldn't be all that surprising that you see something like that.
And you speak from experience, not only as an academician, but you've been involved on the ground level, haven't you?
Yeah, I worked for 5 years in the child welfare system in California with teenagers, and it's one of the reasons that led me to do research on this. I found the 18th birthdays to be rather bittersweet affairs,
So you've translated that into what you're doing now at the University of Chicago and being a spokesperson with knowledge on this across the country. With the budget cuts that we're having around the country and in particular in states like Louisiana, is that affecting the process?
Well, I think it is, but it's interesting. I've been around long enough to see bipartisan support for helping, youth making this transition. Congress overwhelmingly passed a law just a few years ago that allows states the option of extending foster care to 21. And there's a number of states that in the context of horrible budget cuts have seen the wisdom to extend foster care. I think part of it is it's cost beneficial. We did a study that showed that for every dollar a state would spend extending foster care to 21, there would be about $2.5 in returns to society. So I think that when you're able to show that kind of return on investment, even in the context of tough budget times, legislators are willing mm-hmm. to step up.
What's been done in light of the congressional action?
Well, a number of states, California most notably, they used to, you know, up until this last year, they, like Louisiana, discharged young people from care at age 18. They mm-hmm. they passed a law. Governor Schwarzenegger signed the law extending foster care to 21. There's, I think, 18 states now that have submitted plans to the federal government to extend foster care to 21. So it's not all of them yet, but, you know, that's encouraging.
Louisiana is not one of those 18, though, is it?
No.
No. So that's one of the reasons why you're here, I guess.
I think so.
All right. And it's tomorrow, the 6th Louisiana Family Impact Seminar. And one of those who's been involved with this is Dana Hunter, who is a PhD candidate who's also in studio with us. She's with the LSU School of Social Work. Dana, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And what exactly is the intent, the approach of the Impact Seminar? What are you trying to achieve?
The Impact Seminars, they're designed to provide objective, high-quality research to the policymakers so that they can examine policies, programs through a family lens, you know. We want to give them the research that's needed to either affect change.
Well, the research is an important component of this, and I think
that's
Dr.
right.
Courtney can elaborate on this. How much has research helped in determining the course of action from here?
Well, I think research has helped a lot. Federal policy around these young people has, become more and more effective over the last 20 years because of research that showed, first of all, some of the statistics you're talking mm-hmm. about, that young people don't do well, and then more recently, some research that shows that it's a smart idea to allow young people to remain in care to 21. They're more likely to go to college. They're less likely to get pregnant, et cetera. So I think that research has helped nationally. At the state level, I think it really takes state government, state legislators wrapping their mind around, you know, doing the right thing by this population.
Do you have some success stories that you can reveal? We've talked about the challenges, but I'm sure there are some that have done well.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that one of the problems with averages is they're just that. They're an average, and they obscure you know, all the variety mm-hmm. we see. And we've done some research looking at subgroups of young people. And two of the groups we call accelerated adults and emerging adults, basically they're doing well. I would say about half the young people making the transition to adulthood out of care are doing well. They've avoided going to jail. If they have children, they're parenting those children successfully. About half of them obtain some mm-hmm. college. But then you've got some other folks, particularly folks who had kids too early, I think, and then some of the young people who have mental health problems. So it's we have some definite success stories. Mm-hmm. The other success story is just the policy difference. I mean, state of Illinois extended care to 21 a long time ago. Young people there are twice as likely to go to college, much less likely to get pregnant. So I think that's a success story we need to celebrate.
We're visiting with Dr. Mark Courtney, professor in the School of Social Service Administration at the University of Chicago, and Dana Hunter, soon to be Dr. Dana Hunter at the LSU School of Social Work. Tomorrow, there will be the 6th Louisiana Family Impact Seminar, Youth Aging Out of Foster Care, A Call to Action. Each year, approximately 20,000 age out or leave the foster care system at the age of 18 without a permanent family or a place to call home. So what is the target audience for this? Who are you trying to appeal to most directly?
The Impact Seminars are designed for legislators, the policymakers, also child welfare administrators, educators, legislative aides, just those who are in positions to impact policy and policy changes, specifically the legislators.
Do we have more of an issue with this challenge in Louisiana than other states, considering our demographics?
I wouldn't say. I think it's an epidemic nationwide. Foster care youth across this nation are suffering and are in need of policy changes.
All right, 297-5633, still time to talk with Dana Hunter and Dr. Mark Courtney. Charles on North Foster. Hello to you, Charles.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning to your guests. Two quick questions. One is, tomorrow's seminar, is there a way to watch it online, or maybe will there be a YouTube posting of the seminar? And the other one is, for foster parents in America, in particular in Louisiana, is there an organization or an effort to organize them so that they can present this issue to the legislature in a more cohesive manner? Thank you.
Yes, there is. Here in Louisiana, there's a Foster Care Association. That information can be found online. You can maybe Google or search Yahoo for the association here in Louisiana, and they do work closely with our legislators. As far as the YouTube, I don't think we will be recording the presentation tomorrow, mm-hmm. and that's for the purpose. We like our legislators to come and to speak freely and to participate without the pressure of media or, you know, feeling that their thoughts will be broadcasted. So sorry about that.
Well, what happens if some media types show up tomorrow? Will they be escorted from the chamber? Well, research indicates that even when these young people attend college, they're far less likely to earn a degree than their peers. So what about preparation when they're in the system? What can be done to improve that?
Well, I think there's a couple of things to do around that, you know, folks not finishing their degrees. So while they're in the system, a lot of research has shown that the big issue is figuring out who's on first, that the foster parents, social workers quite often think the other one's supposed to be doing the coordination with the school. So I think a lot of the issue is just child welfare agencies working more closely with schools to make sure that kids' educational needs are met, and then vice versa, the schools, you know, taking mm-hmm. some responsibility. Sometimes schools are happy to say, well, this kid, you know, you shipped this kid in from some other place. They're not our kid. I mean, I've been at way too many cocktail parties. My wife's a teacher where they won't know who I am. And some, you know, mm-hmm. a vice principal will say, well, these darn foster kids get shipped into our school. And I try to say to them, you know, hey, those are our kids. You know, they're mm-hmm. society's kids. In college, there's some great, in terms of success stories, there's some great programs out there supporting foster youth in colleges. So I think we are learning about how to do that as well.
What about getting family involved in the policy making? Is that essential to success?
Foster families, the kids' family mm-hmm. of origin? Or
yeah, but, well, I would assume the foster families.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, I think that our most important resource, you know, as a society in terms of raising children are our foster parents, right? The government can't raise kids. People do. The government needs to support those people. And so I think the question around the Foster Parent Association was a very good question. I think there's a lot more we can do with foster parents. One of the challenges for foster parents, for example, is in states that don't extend care to 21 or after 18, it can be hard to allow a young person to remain in your home because there are rules against it, right? I mean, you can't have an unrelated adult living in your home and have a foster care license in many states. So I think getting those people at the table would help resolve some of those problems.
Well, these seminars were created to better connect research and policy and to promote a family perspective in policy making. And tomorrow it's the 6th Annual Louisiana Family Impact Seminar at 5550 Florida Boulevard at the Louisiana Resource Center. As far as pending legislation, Dana, is there anything that is being offered in the upcoming legislative session right now?
Not in the upcoming session, no, sir.
Well, there is the possibility to do that if you make an impression with lawmakers. Is there anything you'd like to see done if you could have it happen?
Surely. Even as Dr. Courtney stated, we'd like to see some legislation in the upcoming years surrounding youth and their educational attainment. Also extending foster care into age 21. Yes. Additionally, some more supports connecting youth with mentors. There was the Fostering Connections to Success Act that was passed. And so just seeing implementation of these policies and seeing more accountability where the youth are being connected to mentors and social supports.
Well, we thank you for joining us today. Good luck tomorrow. Dr. Mark Courtney, thanks for coming this way from the University of Chicago.
My pleasure.
And Dana Hunter, soon to be Dr. Dana Hunter from LSU.
We'll be
back after this time out to talk about the Jindal budget plan. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633 or 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org. If you'd like to communicate with us and perhaps get your questions answered by our next guest, Hunter Torito. He is president of the American Advertising Federation of Baton Rouge, and he's been a busy man in his last few days. He also is with X Design, but independent of his job, he's been talking with people in the Jindal administration about what may happen when the tax reform proposal is rolled out today and tomorrow. And good morning to you, Hunter Torito.
Good morning, Jim. Thank you for having me.
What do you think? You met with whom yesterday?
We met with Tim Barfield and the communication director, Douglas Baker.
And what did they tell you?
Well, there's still a lot left to be decided. Last week, this show, Tuesday morning, whenever you had Tim on, kind of created this media storm. And at the time, they were looking at the possibility of taxing media purchases. So any transaction of an outdoor billboard, a print ad, a radio spot that would appear on this show, for example. They heard us loud and clear. The Daily Report picked up an article on it, and they have taken that off the table. However, still on the table are professional services in general. We're still trying to figure out what all is actually in that umbrella. But advertising services, we have been told, will fall in that category of being taxed.
Will fall
under the umbrella of what will be taxed.
Advertising services.
Correct.
So what does that mean?
So services would be something what X Design's revenue is completely based on. Creative consulting, strategy, social media, any sort of design. You look at freelance designers, freelance copywriters, freelance web designers, anything of that nature. But it's a much bigger picture, because look at whenever an agency competes with another agency in Mississippi or in Texas, we now have a premium of a tax placed on our services. We also don't know what other services or industries are included. We're not sure if
CPAs, lawyers, engineers.
Yeah.
We won't know until
later on today.
And the governor, to his credit, yesterday said, look, this is a work in progress. It's not chiseled in stone. We're revising as we move along. And there's already apparently been one concession, and that, based on what you just told me, the first I've heard it, is that there will not be a tax on advertising.
Correct.
Which I'm sure causes many and the radio, television, newspaper industries to breathe a collective sigh of relief.
Right. However, the fight really, it's not over on the advertising front, because Baton Rouge and across Louisiana is made up of smaller sized agencies, and our revenue isn't driven by a increase of a media cost. And that's where, if you take a company like X Design, 100% of our revenue is service oriented. And that's not just at X Design, that's across the city and across the state. So that's what we're at AAF really fighting for, are those freelancers, are those copywriters, those small 10 person under shops that are trying to get set up.
So what was the response when you visited with Mr. Barfield, Mr. Baker? Did they listen intently and say, we'll reconsider, or what did they tell you?
We were told that, once again, this is all part of them meeting with all the different industry sectors, and that they were taking all of the pros and cons that we were presenting, and that they were going to take it into account. They said the last thing they wanted to do was put anybody out of business.
Okay.
What's that?
No, I'm listening. Keep going.
They didn't want to put anybody out of business. However, it's something that our members are very, very afraid of. So we had a meeting last night. We brought our members. We brought potential AAF members. We had people representing different industries besides creative services together to figure out what's going to be a game plan for us moving forward. And we can't do anything until we find out what exactly is going to be in this tax.
And Tim Barfield is the man who's running the Department of Revenue, even though he does not have the title of secretary. So my impression is that when he speaks, he is speaking for the governor.
I would have to assume the same.
297-5633 is your number for Hunter Torito, president of the American Advertising Federation chapter here in Baton Rouge. John on Harold's Ferry. John, you're on the air with Hunter.
Good morning, Jim. Your guest comments confirm what has been obvious, that despite a lot of the media talking about the governor's plan, there is no plan. He decided to do this, he announced it, and then they're scrambling to try to find out what it means. It seems to be part of a pattern. I don't know what your guest thinks about that.
I would have to agree. I think that last week it was media buys. This week it's not. I hate to say, I don't know if we were low-hanging fruit or maybe an easy target, but we're not. We have AAF as part of a much larger organization. We have national help in D.C., and it's not something that we were just going to let happen without some sort of argument. And once again, we can't even define what industries specifically are even in this. And so it is a lot of speculation. Hopefully this afternoon is going to clear up a lot of things.
877-217-5757, wherever you are, for Hunter Torito, president of the chapter here in Baton Rouge of the American Advertising Federation. And yesterday he strolled to the Capitol. Where'd you meet? It wasn't at some clandestine location, was it?
It was at the Department of Revenue downtown.
All right. Hunter met with Tim Barfield, and Tim says advertising media buys are off the table as a potential source of revenue for the state, but services rendered by advertising agencies, lawyers, accountants, engineers, those are still possibilities.
Correct.
He did not say definitively.
Right. And that was part of their whole process of meeting with these different industry sectors to make sure that there wasn't some fatal blow that could be delivered. So we're not sure exactly what everything entails.
Terry and Walker. Good morning, Terry. You're on the air with Hunter.
I would like to know if your guest remembers Governor Martinez of Florida about 20, 30 years ago. Tried to put a tax on media and on advertising in Florida, and it didn't work.
Yeah.
It's interesting you bring that up. One of the case studies that we saw was Florida, and one of the most unique things was all of the advertisers pulled out. All of the conferences, advertising conferences, left, and they were left with no choice but to repeal the tax. They even dumped Lipton branded instant tea into all of the fountains and waters as a tea protest. So this has happened in other cities. This is actually a headline news in Advertising Age this week of Minnesota and the same exact fight. And the governor looks to be taking steps back. This was also in Iowa in the late 80s. Didn't work. So every time that we have seen something like this, on paper it looks great. Mm-hmm. Whenever it's put into action, it completely falls apart.
Well, the governor has stated with his people leading the charge, the governor did not talk much about this until yesterday, that this is a revenue neutral proposition. That's the intent. So in order for it to be revenue neutral, you either have to raise the sales taxes more than is being advertised right now, or go after some other people who have not been taxed as much as they have before or at all. So revenue neutrality to somebody could be bankruptcy to somebody else, and I think they got the message loud and clear that many media entities would be going out of business if they had to face a 12% advertising tax. So what about some would say, look, lawyers and engineers and accountants, they do a lot better than media types. So as you say, that they're the low-hanging fruit. What do you think is going to happen?
I'm interested to see. I honestly don't know. I think that we are definitely going to have to work with those industries. We're going to have to put together a coalition, not just of advertising professionals, mm-hmm. but of the engineers, of the CPAs, because you look at an engineering group, you look at a CPA group, they go through a bidding process as well. And if there's a premium placed on their services and they're competing against Mississippi, Alabama, Texas, wherever it may be, it's just going to be tougher and tougher and tougher for these industries to compete.
And in your business, the advertising business, there are several shops here in Baton Rouge and across the state. I would think that some might have difficulties keeping their doors open if they faced an ambitious new tax.
Right. And on a national level, advertising can be broken down into the media buy and the creative service. And usually it's an 80-20% breakdown. 80% of a client's budget goes towards the media buy, and only 20% goes towards creative services. That's typical for a large agency, 100-plus people. Baton Rouge and across Louisiana just doesn't have those type of companies. It's the smaller shops. 100% of their revenue is based on advertising services rendered, not on a media purchase. So you're going to see these one- and two-man shops close their doors completely, probably go find a job. We're still waiting to see of what about the companies that have internal marketing departments? So places like a Lamar, places like Woman's Hospital, Blue Cross Blue Shield, where they actually have full-fledged creative marketing services, copywriting, film editing, graphic designers, all of those different services. Are those going to be taxed? If not, you're going to see clients hiring in-house to work around that 6% premium of hiring outside.
Okay. And it is interesting that the governor's top aide, and this time it's coming outside the administration since he's formed his company on message, Timmy Teeple, his father, Tommy, is one of the top executives at Lamar Advertising. And we live in a small town, small state. It seems like everybody's interconnected in some way. And you can bet that the phones will be ringing a lot, even though the governor has taken his foot off the gas on a media advertising tax. These other taxes are not going to sit well with some people.
Correct.
297-5633, Lee and Geismar. Lee, good morning. You're on the air with Hunter.
Yeah, I have a prediction to make. I predict that Governor General won't pass the tax on media, and that he'll do like he always does, cut something out of the budget pertaining to the indigent or the poor or the working man, and just pass the tax on to the working fellow to get him to subsidize the budget.
There's always a cynic. But I'm sure Lee's not alone in his sentiments. The governor, based on his latest poll numbers, his strategy is not working as well as it did in his first term as far as his approach to governing the state of Louisiana. And he has portrayed himself, and to this point he has he's kept the philosophy in order as far as being an anti-tax governor. But now it's kind of curious that this anti-tax governor, Bobby Jindal, is now being associated with taxes, new taxes of all kinds. I'm sure he does not like that.
Absolutely not. And I'm interested to see what, you know, are they going to be able to include lawyers in this? And I think if they do, I don't think it'll stand a chance. But we're talking about a much, much bigger picture than just advertising services here. We're talking about jobs. We're talking about, you know, potentially agencies closing their doors, less jobs to be had. You know, you look at something like the digital media and film tax incentives of how much that has brought into our state because of the breaks, whereas this feels like the exact opposite. It's going to push things out of our state.
297-5633. There's still time to talk with Hunter Torito, president of the American Advertising Federation of Baton Rouge. And yesterday when you met with Tim Barfield, did you feel like you were a lobbyist for your organization, or were you there for an information session? What was your intent when you walked in that room?
Our intent was to just get as much information as we possibly could. And I will say that the Department of Revenue did provide us with, they were very open about everything, that any questions that we had, they had answered. But then also, we wanted to throw out there of, you know, the 80-20 breakdown of media versus creative services doesn't always exist everywhere in Louisiana. Also, let's talk about social media. lots of brands, lots of small agents, lots of small companies are trying to utilize it more and more as a marketing tool because of its low entry cost. But now we're going to tax that.
Okay. Randy in Mid-City says advertising, especially political advertising, is as annoying as cigarette smoke. Why should ad buys be exempt from any expanded sales tax coverage if other services like barbers will have to pay for it? That's Randy in Mid-City.
Well, why pick on just advertising? Why us? It would be a question back.
And that there's a competitive aspect to this. If Louisiana has a tax and nobody else in the country does, that's one issue, and there are many others. And the other comes down to free speech. We're hearing all this consternation about violation of the Second Amendment. If you start taxing free speech, are we violating the First Amendment? So there would be all kinds of court challenges, and it's something I don't think this governor wants to get involved in to that extent, and that's probably why he has pulled back. Ace in Prairieville. Hi, Ace. You're on the air with our guest, Hunter Torito.
Hey, Hunter. This is Ace.
Hey, Ace.
How are you doing?
Doing well, Ace. Good to hear your voice.
Yeah, I appreciate you going on and fighting for this. I want to point out a couple of things. That is, it's been in the media lately. We talk about being the creative capital of the South and investing in young professionals, trying to keep them here in the Baton Rouge and Louisiana area to better our state. And then this is how we treat them. As you pointed out with the film industry, we give tax breaks to pull those people in, creatives and production shops to come here, and we're trying to build that up. And yet here we are, kneecapping creatives in the advertising industry, and it infuriates me.
I couldn't agree with Ace more. I'm a young professional here in Baton Rouge. I was born and raised here, never left the city, and I'm proud to call it home. You know, we've seen people, you know, even recently at X Design, one of our employees left town to go to Austin. And how can we ever compete with these other places if we're driving it away? It really saddens me that this is what it's come down to, because these are very passionate people about what they do.
Joe downtown, please be brief. Joe, you're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to make a point more specific to the revenue standpoint of these changes. This is very close to what I do for a living, and I'm going to tell you, they don't have a clue of how much revenue that they're going to collect when they implement all of these changes at once. I mean, they have a hard enough time estimating revenue by methods that we've been using for years. When they go to change this, it's going to be a heart attack to our budget. And if you think we're in a very budgetary, vicarious situation now, you wait till 2 or 3 years down the road.
All right, we'll return a few more minutes with Hunter Torito and then Dan Bornay of the Louisiana Chemical Association, and he's also Deacon Dan. We'll talk with him about a few things when we return. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. In just a moment, Dan Bornay of the Louisiana Chemical Association. And we're wrapping it up with Hunter Torito, president of the American Advertising Federation chapter in Baton Rouge. How many members are in your chapter?
Over 230 members.
230 members who were waiting to hear from you yesterday, probably as much as we Roman Catholics were waiting to see who the next pope was. And so when you got out of your meeting, you had another meeting, didn't you?
Correct. We had a meeting yesterday afternoon at Lamar to just brief everybody on what was happening and really to start collecting names and start figuring out who's going to be responsible for what whenever this thing comes.
What's your strategy from here on? Where do you go from here?
First and foremost, we see what comes out in this. So what other industries are being taxed? We start to form coalitions with those industries, and we start to look towards AAF District, which is throughout mm-hmm. the Southeast, and AAF National, and they will be helping us lead this charge on a local, regional, and national effort. And from there, we just kind of start going with a grassroots campaign. I mean, you're talking to a group of professionals in the advertising industry that are known for creative messaging. So what
better
there
will be a lot of creative messaging going on.
Absolutely.
I would imagine you'll be twisting some arms of lawmakers as well.
Absolutely.
Remember, the governor can't do this unilaterally. He needs two-thirds support of both the House and the Senate. So it would seem to be a tough call for the governor to accomplish this, and he can't do it without public support.
Absolutely.
So public opposition is something that he's taking to heart and apparently took quickly to heart when it came to the media advertising tax. See, Tim Barfield told you, off the table.
Off the table. And we look forward to not seeing that on that bill as it comes out this afternoon.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're joined now by Dan Bornay, who wears more hats than any man on the planet. And he's right here in our community. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Jim. How are you? Enjoying the show, as always.
Well, thank you. And you, as I stated, president of the Louisiana Chemical Association, could this tax proposal affect you in any way?
Well, it's certainly going to affect, I think, all taxpayers in the state, one way or the other. It's a question of how it will affect certain sectors of our economy. We're looking at a number of proposals that we've talked to the administration about over the last couple of months, actually. As your previous guest said, the administration has been very forthcoming in talking about alternatives and its direction in terms of where it feels like the tax code ought to be. What we think will come out, we're not sure yet, but as of late last week, of course, the elimination of the taxes that the governor's already indicated, the personal income tax, corporation franchise tax, and corporate income tax, and then an uptick in the sales tax, and then services would be subject. Many services would be subject to the new tax. For our industry, particularly here in Louisiana, I think the three that immediately come to mind would be engineering services, accounting services, because we do a lot of both, and, of course, legal services. We have a lot of legal bills as well. So those would be subject to taxation for the first time. The last thing we heard from the staff, and again, I want to compliment it for being so forthcoming, is that construction and maintenance would not be subject to the new tax. That would be a very large tax on our industry, especially at a time when we're looking at over $70 billion of investment coming to the state. You know, our companies are diversified. There are 65 of them. They're all multinationals. They have very complicated tax situations. Some cut certain ways, some cut other ways. We're just going to have to take a look at what the final proposal looks like, final as it could be at this early stage of the game, evaluate it, and then decide how it impacts our industry. That's where we are right now.
Dan Bornay with us, and we shall follow this, and we will know much more today and tomorrow regarding where the tax plan is going, and legislators will convene for the start of the session on the 8th day of April. Now, as I stated, Dan wears a few different hats, and he is
Jim, can I just rewind on that 1 second?
Sure.
And say that I think what we're hearing in the field as we go around and talk to legislators and others who are going to watch this very closely is that there will have to be a constituency of some kind who strongly feels that this needs to happen. Because as you pointed out in your lead-in, it takes two-thirds vote in both the House and the Senate for these major changes to happen. And somehow I think the governor will attempt to cobble together a coalition of interests that feel like that this is a beneficial thing to do. And as you know, you've watched this process for many, many years. You have to have those coalitions in order to get to two-thirds.
Yes, you do. Well, you are Deacon Dan as well, and we have a new pope for the 1.2 billion Roman Catholics in the world. What's your take of Pope Francis I?
Well, of course, it's a very exciting time for all Catholics around the world, 1.2 billion of us. What we have is a Jesuit. This is the first Jesuit pope in history. The Jesuits are known to be, if not the most educated, certainly the most educated group of priests. And you have a very highly educated, intellectual cardinal taking on the mantle of what many believe to be the most humble servant in all of the church, and that is St. Francis of Assisi, who renounced wealth, renounced power, and wore a tattered cape his entire ministry. It's a beautiful thing to, it's a beautiful image when this pope bowed and asked that all of the Christians in St. Peter's Square pray for him first before he prayed for them. It's a mark of great humility, and I think it's going to be a standard that he will maintain throughout his papacy.
In Vatican City last night, and mind you, with the time change or time difference, it was night in Vatican City. More than 100,000 people were waiting in the rain to find out who the next pope was. And it not only was a change in a Jesuit being the new pope, but Dan, this one comes from South America. This is a remarkable turn of events.
Well, it is, and it's interesting. You know, the Holy Spirit doesn't read the paper. The Holy Spirit doesn't listen to newscasts to determine how he should vote. But what he does, and we as Catholics are faithful to this, is that the Holy Spirit influences these types of conclaves, and that these cardinals, after prayerful thought, decided to go outside of the European orb and bring in, for the first time, a cardinal from the New World, a cardinal that represents, in terms of language certainly, a very, very strong percentage of Catholics worldwide because of the Spanish language. And so it indicates, I think, great unity in our church. Those who would have preferred this voting to go on for days and days and days to indicate some kind of disunity have missed the point totally. I think the church, although it has many problems that it has to deal with, is nevertheless unified under the guidance of the Holy Spirit to be the church that it is called to be.
All right. So as a Catholic, it's not surprising for you to believe that there is a divine element to this and that the Holy Spirit is calling the shots. Does the Holy Spirit call the shots in any way when we elect presidents or governors or mayors or people like that as public servants in our little world?
Well, I think that what the Holy Spirit expects Catholics to do is to be informed citizens and to study the positions of those who offer themselves a public office and to prayerfully evaluate how we might be faithful citizens. I don't think the Holy Spirit decides who gets elected president. I think what the Holy Spirit does, it leaves it to individuals to call on him for guidance. And in good conscience, how people vote is their sacred right, and hopefully many would think their sacred duty, because I think we all need to vote in every possible election if we can.
Well, 25 years ago today, Charles Elson Buddy Romer III became governor of Louisiana on this date, March 14th, 1988. Do you recall that day, Dan?
I remember it very well. I remember it well, and I think one of the things that really sticks in my mind is that when Buddy became governor, he was denied a mandate because Edwin pulled out before runoff could be held. And he came into the governorship with just a little over a third of the vote. So when you begin governing from what is basically a minority status in terms of the electorate, it becomes an uphill battle from that point on, Jim. And I think we know that he had a tough battle over those 4 years.
And he had some battles with you, didn't he?
He did. And, you know, in the end, we had some great progress because due to his leadership, and I must say, due to the leadership of Kip Holden, who was in the House at the time, and I think without Kip's leadership, this would have never happened. We ended up enacted the strongest air toxics bill in the country. And it's still strong among states. And so what we did back then, after a lot of fits and starts, we came, came up with, I thought, an excellent piece of legislation. Tim Hardy played a role. Mike McDaniel played a role. Certainly, the governor did, Kip Holden, and the Secretary of Environmental Quality as well, Paul Tomplay.
At the time, though, the governor, didn't he implement a report card? You didn't like that very much, did you?
No, we didn't, because what he was establishing was a double jeopardy situation where you mixed environmental compliance with tax incentives. And our point was, if you are not environmentally compliant, fine, penalize, do whatever you have to do to fix that, but don't use that as a standard for whether or not a company gets an investment incentive to bring jobs to the state. And, of course, that scorecard died a natural death, and he had a very difficult time getting his own Board of Commerce and Industry to go along with it. I think it significantly contributed in the end to his loss of support among a large group of the manufacturing community. But I wasn't put on earth to give Buddy Romo political advice. If I had been asked, I would certainly have given him a different line of attack.
Well, it was 25 years ago today that it was a beautiful day. Buddy Romer took the oath of office as governor at the age of 44, and he invited every governor in America to be there. He was so proud to be governor of Louisiana. Only one other governor showed. Do you remember who it was?
Probably the fellow who was his Harvard buddy from Arkansas from... Where?
No, it was Bill Clinton.
Oh, Bill came. Really?
Bill didn't go to Harvard, though. Buddy did.
No. But there was a fellow who was...
Oh, Ray Mabus. Mississippi. Right. I don't think he was governor yet.
Right.
But Clinton was there, and so was Hillary. And I remember Clinton saying he just was enthused as could be about Buddy Romer being governor of Louisiana. Those two eventually had some issues, too, but I recall Buddy Romer saying, I love Louisiana. I love Louisiana. And he called it the prettiest state in America. Clinton took exception with that statement, but he was very proud to be governor of Louisiana. And it used to be, Dan, that being governor was the big thing for any young man or woman born in Louisiana. But now it seems that these young men and women who are born in Louisiana, they want to be president. Governor is just kind of a way station on the way to the Oval Office.
Well, being governor is a pretty good gig. I remember when I was working for Senator Russell Long, and I had the opportunity to come down to Louisiana to work for Governor Edwards in his first term. I was really torn, and the senator said, Dan, you should do that because you're going to find that governors are twice as powerful as senators. And I said, what do you mean? He says, well, there's two of us and there's one of him. And that was sort of Senator Long's way of putting it into numbers. And once I got down here, I found out he was right. A governor of Louisiana has tremendous influence and tremendous opportunity to do well. It would still be a prized, a prized position for anyone serious about governing.
Well, and it's a case in which one of our U.S. senators, David Bruce Vitter, may very well try to be the next governor of Louisiana. And as you say, some people would say, why would he leave a job that has a six-year term that he could probably win a few more times for a job that has term limits and only 4 years? Well, being governor, as you say, is still a remarkable position in Louisiana.
Let me give you an example. Harry Bellman was the governor of Oklahoma. He came to the U.S. Senate as a senator, and he went stir-crazy, so much so he served a term and went back and got elected governor of Oklahoma again. Fritz Hollings came as governor of South Carolina to the Senate. He went stir-crazy. Lawton Childs was governor of Florida. He came to the Senate. He went stir-crazy. You know, the governorship is so different because when you press a button, the National Guard shows up. In the Senate, that doesn't happen, and I don't doubt any U.S. senator having an opportunity would certainly look at the governorship of his state.
Well, Dan, we always enjoy talking with you, and as stated, this man wears a number of hats, including being the voice of the Valley, Death Valley, Tiger Stadium. What year will this be for you, Dan?
This will be my 28th year, and let's remind people I only call the plays after they run them. Some people think I call the plays before they run them, but no, that's a way, way, way higher than my pay grade.
28 years, and how many years at the Pete Maravich Assembly Center?
I have just finished my 25th year at the PMAC. Kent Lowe and I started the same year together.
So 25 years for Dan Bornay at the PMAC, and 25 years ago today, Buddy Romer became governor of Louisiana. At 44, it looked like he might be on his way to the presidency. He never won another election.
Now he's on his way to making money, and I'm happy for him.
Oh, that's okay. Thank you, Dan. Appreciate it. Take care. Have a good one. And thank you for listening, everybody. Until tomorrow, for Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.